Good afternoon. We're going to call the Tax Committee to order. I think we're getting the tape on right now. So good afternoon and welcome back, Commissioner and Ms. Von Mosch. We were nice to see you today. And I don't have the list in front of me of the... Emily's not here, but we'll get it from Emily. And I think the first person on the list was Representative Runbeck. We don't see her yet, so I don't know who the second person... We can come back to her. Was the second person on the list Representative Barrett, I believe. So Representative Barrett, question for the Commissioner. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Franz, thank you for coming again for a second date.
There it is.
It's always difficult to start the second day of a hearing because a lot of your energy is kind of dissipated over the last 24-hour period. Maybe you could talk for 5 minutes to get my ire up again regarding the budget. No, I'm just kidding with that. But can you explain? I know I've heard you talk a few times about having a structural deficit. Can you explain that concept for me, please?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative. Well, I'll try. I think it's a good discussion point, and whether I get your ire up or not, we'll see. But I think that what we've really been looking at from the governor's perspective, when we talk about structural deficit, we look at what's been happening the last, you know, 9 out of the last 11 years where we've had deficits, and what we look toward is how can we position ourselves so we have a budget that's sustainable, not just for this current biennium of 2014 and 2015, but for the longer term. And so we really wanted to make sure that we looked not just at this current biennium, but the next one as well. And that's why the governor, when he made his proposal to both, you know, cover this current deficit and make some investments, but also make sure that the revenue stream matches the funding level that we all agree to. So that's why in the next biennium, you'll see there is a surplus, and the surplus, in fact, is enough to pay back the entire school ship. So the structural deficit, from our point of view, really was trying to look at making sure that the budget that we adopt, that this legislature approves and sends to the governor, the budget that we adopt for this biennium has a revenue stream that will match this biennium and the next one as well. So.
Thank you, Madam
Barrett.
Commissioner Franz, can you tell me then, I don't know if I ever heard how much the tax increase is going to be related to Governor Dayton's proposal. How much is the total tax increase?
Madam Chair, Representative, so in the process of kind of backing up a little bit and looking at the first thing we needed to do was to generate enough revenue to solve the $1.1 billion deficit and make the investment. So the total additional revenue for this current, for the 2014-2015 biennium was about $2.1 billion.
And then Representative Barrett.
Sure. Commissioner Franz, how much of the $2.1 billion in additional taxes is going out and spending, new spending?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, I don't have the exact figures on the spending in front of me, and I could get that schedule for you, but that's not something I usually speak directly to very often. I don't want to get the numbers wrong, so otherwise I'd be glad to get that information for you.
Representative Barrett.
Sure. Well, if I can, I think this year's budget, I think, ended up at around 35.2, and I believe that Governor Dayton's budget is around 37.8. Does that sound about right?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe the 37, what did you say, 0.8 billion? I think that's right.
Further?
So, Madam Chair, Commissioner, then it seems like we're increasing spending by over 2.1 billion. And if that's right, I guess I want to question more the structural deficit concept in that, you know, going back to the maybe the Viking Stadium analogy, if you have, just theoretical question here, if you had $1 billion or $2 billion in statutorily obligated expenses and you had $2 billion in projected revenue, either from a tax increase or an increase in the economy, what's more likely to happen? Statutorily obligated expenses or the revenue?
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, obviously that depends on your ability to estimate the current, future economic activity, but, you know, the forecast assumes that both will happen, actually.
Sure.
Please.
And, And so my point here is that we look at the Viking Stadium. I know we got into that a little bit yesterday. I think Representative Garofalo mentioned that. I wasn't one of those people that voted for the stadium because a lot of reasons, primarily because I knew right away that that revenue was not going to come in. I knew that that relied on electronic pull tab revenue, that it was estimated to go from $1 billion to $2.8 billion. Couldn't happen, and it won't happen. And so I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at $2 billion in projected tax increases. I'm looking at $2 billion in projected expense increases. And I know you've said many times about the structural integrity and the structural deficit. I don't see how we get there, given the fact that it's much more likely that those expenses are have to come in. We have to spend the money if we, if we obligate it through statute. I don't understand that, and I'm looking for you maybe to enlighten me a little bit on that.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, glad to. I think, let me just first of all make a deal with a reference to the electronic pull tabs. I think one of the things that in the projections that we made on the electronic pull tab, addition of electronic pull tab to the charitable gambling industry was based upon the Charitable Gambling Board's assumption about how fast the process and these new sites would come on board, how quickly they would adopt the electronic gaming opportunities. And that's been slower than anticipated, you're correct. And I think one of the things that we're looking at now and we'll look at with the February forecast is looking at the slow startup time that incurred and look at what additional assumptions we need to make about that revenue stream. So we're watching that closely, and we understand that that's an issue. But with respect to looking at, the budgeting process and making changes in the budget and looking forward, I mean, one of the things that was clearly evident to all of us sitting on the budget table was that the current system is simply not sustainable. That if you look at the way that we solved the budget in the last biennium by borrowing money from schools, by selling the tobacco bonds, well, clearly that money, that one-time money now, isn't here to support the spending that was approved. So what you have when you make those kind of one-time fixes, if you will, to the budget is you're going to have a definite hole in the next biennium for revenue to support that spending that was solved by one-time funding mechanisms. So what the governor's been trying to do is say, let's quit doing that, and let's actually take a look at what are we going to spend, how are we going to solve the deficit, how are we going to have a surplus in the next biennium so we can pay back the school shift. But let's do that in an honest, direct way so the revenue stream supports the funding that we all agree to up here in this legislature. So I think that's the key for him, is that the current system is unsustainable.
Representative Barrett.
I don't want to belabor the point, but I guess I go back to my original question, which is then if you raise increased taxes by $2.1 billion and you increase expenses by at least that or more, you've done nothing structurally. All you've done is created a second structure on your house that will fall even farther when the revenue doesn't come in, as we've already seen with the Viking Stadium analysis.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, I would disagree with your analysis. I think that in terms of the projections that are made based on economic forecast and changes in law, it's quite clear to us that if we make these changes in the tax law to support the revenue that we anticipate, that it will support the budget that we propose, assuming, budget projections are as they are.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, another question for you. Could you tell me how much is the sales tax increase going to give the state of Minnesota for the next 4 years, the next two bienniums?
Commissioner. They're looking.
I think if you go to the budget pages, the policy pages, is this a better chart? Madam Chair, Representative, there is a chart toward the end. It's right behind. So right behind the budget narrative, at the very first are the budget narrative pages, and then there's a chart right at after that called the Governor's Fiscal 2014-15 Tax Revenue. Yes, Madam
Looks
Chair.
Looks like this member's page.
So could you recite what those numbers are so I make sure I'm on the right page? Commissioner France.
So when
Did you, excuse me, Representative Barrett, are you talking about on this page, line 28, the sales and use that we're looking at here?
I'm not sure I'm on the right page, but
okay.
That's probably the page I'm looking at.
I think the total line is.
Madam Chair, I think if you go to that page, you look at line 28, which is a subtotal for sales and use tax. I think if you go there, you'll see that for the first biennium, the net increase is $2.083 billion. And if you look at the collection, the total in the next column over under fiscal year 2016-17, you'll see $3.39 billion representative. And those are the totals of the sales tax revenue, additional sales tax revenue brought in during those years. I just might point out we got into this a little bit yesterday. If you'll notice, the first fiscal year, 2014, is less than some of the other years. That's because we start half year, so it starts at January 1, 2014.
Representative Barrett.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Ferrand, so for the next biennium, we're increasing sales tax by $2.8 billion. And then for the 2017 biennium, it's $3.3 billion. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, the overall net effect of both reducing the rate to 5.5% and the base expansion does equal those totals, yes.
So that would be a total of, Madam Chair,
yes, please.
That'd be a total of $6.1 billion in the next four-year period of time. Commissioner.
Commissioner.
I believe your math is, Madam Chair, I believe your math is correct, yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, then, Commissioner, that's about $3,000 per family in Minnesota. And I'm wondering, given that, how long is it going to take us to pay back the shift? When do we actually pay that shift back?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure what shift.
Regarding the education shift and the fact that Governor Dayton does not have any dollars committed in the next biennium to paying back the shift, when does that shift actually get paid back?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Governor Dayton proposes paying back the entire shift in the second biennium federal in fiscal year 2016 and 2017. But I might just add that in terms of looking at the increases that you're talking about, you need, I think when you look at the way that the sales tax rate reduction affects families and consumers, you'll see that we can go through this a little bit more in detail later on, but you'll see that the average or typical consumer will not pay any additional sales tax, but the typical consumer will pay about the same or somewhat less. But this additional revenue that you're looking at here and the overall budget, both in terms of fiscal 14 and 15 and fiscal 16 and 16, does, you know, three major things. It solves the deficit of $1.1 billion, makes investments, and it pays back the entire school shift by the end of 2016 and 2017. So I guess the question is, if you're asking why didn't the governor pay for the school shift in 2014 and 2015, it's another $1.1 billion. And if you have some ideas on how to raise additional revenue to do that in 2014 and 2015, we're certainly open to suggestions.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, well, what I'm, I guess a lot of things I'm alluding to. One is the fact that it's going to take us $6.1 billion in tax increases to pay off a $1 billion shift. And
yes,
I
sir.
Find that ratio unacceptable.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, actually, the budget does a number of things, as I mentioned. It's not all going toward paying off the school shift. The budget that the governor has proposed with these sales tax items in it include solving the $1.1 billion deficit that has to be paid for with money somewhere or cut somewhere, right? And we have a number of investments that the governor makes in his budget for 2014 and 2015. And in addition, he pays off the entire school debt of $1.1 billion in 2016 and 2017. So this plan takes care of all those items, and it does so in a way that is transparent and straightforward. And so our challenge to you, Representative, is do you have another plan that can accelerate the payment of the school shift before 2016 and 2017?
Madam Chair.
Barrett and members, we had a long list, so I'm just reminding folks.
Sure. Thank you.
Please.
Madam Chair, now, I do have a few more questions, so I'd be happy to ask one more, and then if you want to put me on at the end, I'd be happy to go on.
And there's no problem. I mean, I think we've seen that, you know, we're letting members, as they question, ask about six questions. Everybody has to remember that there's a whole long list. And so yesterday we kind of we let everybody who talked ask multiple questions, and I want to continue that. I just want members to be aware of that as you're asking questions. So please, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Franz, how much did revenue change in the last couple bienniums?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, you mean in terms of the fluctuation of total revenues?
The 2010 biennium compared to the 2012 biennium.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have that, but I can get that information for you.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, I actually have that. It went from $30 billion to $34 billion. Now, the $30 billion in 2010 was augmented by, I think, $2 billion. It was either $1 or $2 billion from federal money, one-time federal money. So the revenue went up $4 billion. And that didn't happen through tax increases. So you'd ask me for my ideas on how to raise revenue. It's by expanding the pie. It's making the pie bigger. It's not by taking from the pie, because when you take from the pie, you're taking from the private sector, you're taking from families. So the way to pay back the shift, as about $1 billion has already been paid back, is by increasing that pie, increasing economic activity, and not stifling it. So that would be my comment on how we actually pay back the rest of the shift that we've already started paying back from the 2010 shift.
I called Representative Runbeck, but she's still not here. For members who, just before I called Representative Moline, I think what folks want to look at on the bottom line, if I understand it, is line 48, which has all the taxes exchanged for the general fund. You can see all the revenue changes. But, you know, I do, if I may, I do want to comment a little bit on the discussion we had yesterday and today, which is, you know, to say that, yes, the shift issue is a question, but the way I understand it, and, you know, I think there'll be changes legislatively between the House and Senate. We'll have different, you know, the way we order our priorities, but I understand the governor is fully paying off the shift. I'm hearing that, you know, some wish it were quicker, and, you know, I think that's a bipartisan issue. And in fact, we are all beneficiaries of the negotiated agreement between Governor Dayton and the now minority, formerly majority's deal that brought us to where we sit today. And so, you know, we have to recall that how we got where we got is what Governor Dayton and the Republican majorities agreed to. So that was the number that got us to the number that Representative Barrett's talking about. It wasn't one party, it was a dual party agreement to solve last year's situation, and we can all go backward and talk about what we didn't or did like, and, you know, but going forward, that a shift payment was agreed to by both sides of the aisle when last session, that it was going to get paid back this way, and in fact, I think we all have to recall that it's actually being paid off much faster than anyone thought. So when that deal was struck at the end of last session, people did not think that 2-point-something of the school shift would be only 1.1 today. That was a nice thing we all learned in the November forecast. So I do just want to remind people the perspective of what people were predicting, how many years it would take for that shift to get paid back, and that the agreement in current law is one that was a bipartisan agreement. I do think that there is a bipartisan feeling in the House among some members that we'd like to work with the governor to see if we could get some of that going maybe a little bit quicker, but I don't want to leave it on the record that the governor doesn't intend to pay back the school shift. So I think I can see that very clearly, and he's paying it back at the same rate that was agreed to in the bipartisan agreement of last session. So, you know, we do have the public listening to us, and so with all due respect, I want to point that out. That is, you know, folks thought we would have a $2.7 billion school shift to pay back, and we learned something different in November, and we were happy about that. So we're still moving in that direction, and I think those conversations will go forward. But I think we all have strong feelings about everything in taxes, and that's why we're all on this committee, Commissioner. So I do want to just say to you personally thank you, and please tell the governor thank you for trying to take a look at all these moving parts. You know, for me, what I like is there's no gimmicks anymore. So I think that's fantastic. I think, you know, you all should anticipate we have different feelings here about the minutiae of the provisions. And I want to respect and have said to a number of minority members in private that, you know, I understand we have profound differences on tax policy. And I think we all know that here. You know, that's not a surprise in this room. And we really feel very differently about this. But, you know, I think it needs to be said what everybody already knows is this new majority, and Minnesotans may have a different feeling about us in 2 years, we are going to raise revenue. And so it just needs to be said. We have said that we would like a balanced approach, and just part of that balance is revenue. So, you know, this new majority stands ready to assist in that regard. We're not sure exactly how we're going to get there, but I understand that there are many people here who do not support revenue, and I want to respect that. But I do think what could be helpful going forward as we look to how we're going to, you know, end the session is, even if you can't vote for a bill, even if you can't support a nickel of revenue, can you help us design and think through pieces that are not as objectionable compared to others? And I think, you know, it would be helpful to just think about that it's likely that this governor, you know, he's put his bill on the table and said, this is what I want. And I just think people should expect that with Democrats in charge of the House and Senate that we are going to have revenue. And so I hope that we, in the first, you know, month or so here, we could be done with the and we probably never will be, but, you know, this idea that there won't be new revenue at the end of the day, because there's going to be. And so, again, trying to be respectful of the minority that folks aren't going to want to vote for that. I'm not under any illusion that folks are going to vote for more revenue on one side of the aisle. But I still think it's helpful if people can bipartisanly kind of bring their best ideas forward. And I certainly want to do that, and I ask all the Democrats as well, you know, get involved on what you like, what you don't like, and try to put your best foot forward. I don't have any intention of shutting out any members' ideas. I don't, and Representative Davids did the same thing. And when I was in the minority before, my chairs, Representative Krinke and Representative Abrams, did this. You know, we're not going to put together a bill that's just Democrats' bills, and because, you know, we don't think Republicans are going to vote for the bill. We want your best ideas and your bills. You have things for your communities, and if they can pass the muster of this committee, they're going to be in the omnibus tax bills. But I just really hope that we don't spend this week and next and next and next sort of, you know, being against everything. And I know I say that at the risk of offending some people here. But, you know, that's just me putting it on the table that this committee's charge is to raise some revenue this year. We are the tax committee, and this will not be a tax bill at the end of the day that doesn't have tax increases in it. And we're not ducking that. And, yeah, there's a laugh over there. So, you know, I mean, take that for what it's worth. It's just a feeling I've been having sort of watching things unfold. You know, I don't know everything about the governor's proposal either, and I'm learning too. And so I do really genuinely want to thank you, and I probably should have thanked you and the governor's office in the last committee hearing, because I know this is a big, big proposal to carry, and we all have a lot of work to do, so.
Madam Chair.
Yes, please, Commissioner.
Thank you for your comments. I appreciate that. And the Governor, really, your comments about all of us in this room together are really important, because the Governor, I think, is oftentimes given credit for both sides agreeing to the payback of the school shift, because we have made some really significant payments of that. Like you say, almost $1.6 billion has already been paid back, and that was based upon an agreement to put in place a structure so that when we had surpluses that were generated by additional revenue, we've made those payments back, and that's a really good thing. You know, and let's all cross our fingers if things work out well, and there could be an additional surplus at the end of this fiscal year, which could make another payment on the school shift, which would make, I think, everyone happy. I'm not predicting, by the way, any forecasting or anything along that lines. I'm just saying we are a little bit ahead in revenues. And if things continue well, then there could be another payment. And so that's, I think you're right, that's an artifact, if you will, of the agreement of everyone to say, we've got to make that payment back. And so, you know, as much as we go back and forth on the best way to structure this package, the governor gives a lot of credit to both sides of the aisle for making sure that we put that debt on the front burner and we work on it. Now, obviously, he's got a different perspective about the timing. We understand that. And, you know, just to be clear, that was not one of priorities. It was one of sort of feeling like the money, the deficit, and the investments were needed, and we needed to wait to pay that off. But anyway, I just wanted to say thank you for those comments about the working together. I think one of the things the governor has made clear to me is that when we get some good ideas, let's take them and let's talk about them, and let's see what we can do to make the package better. We think it's a package. We obviously think that this thing works together as a package. And if you start pulling things out, you got to figure out either put new revenue in or you change spending or whatever, and so we've got to deal with those hard questions. But we really would look forward to working with this committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I'm going to thank you to Representative Barrett and every committee member who is asking questions, because it's helping us all. And I'm just trying to get as constructive as possible here. So Representative Moline, and then if Representative Runback comes in, we'll go to her.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that Representative Barrett's questions and sort of your recent comments will hopefully be a good segue into my one question, so I will be brief, and then I think I just have maybe a brief comment after that. But Commissioner, we've been talking a lot about sort of fluctuations in revenue, and of course we can't always predict what the revenue will be because it depends on how much people buy and how much income they're making. You know, we can't say for sure what the economic growth will be. So I heard some questions yesterday from Representative Garofalo and Representative Barrett today about sort of some of the guessing that's going on, which I think happens in, you know, every budget cycle. But my question to you is more specific, and I've heard a couple of mentions today about one-time money. And I just want to make sure, looking at the governor's budget, is there any one-time money in this budget proposal, you know, either from the federal government that will only be able to be guaranteed to have once, or, you know, some sort of regional pot of money or something else that, you know, we're sort of using to fill the hole for the next biennium, but that we know for sure won't be there the biennium that follows? So I guess that's my question, if there's any one-time money in this budget.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, thank you for the question. You know, as I checking through my list to make sure, but certainly there's nothing in there that we put in that we believe should be a one-time fix. All of the proposals are designed to be ongoing and structurally supporting our revenue stream going forward. I think one of the areas that we really wanted to make sure that we talked about in terms of sustainability for the budget was to make sure that the revenue system was designed to be more sustainable. There was a government budget trend study was in 2009. I want to allude back to in terms of the concerns about budgeting and volatility and making sure that we have a revenue stream that supports our budgeting process. I know one of the things that we're all concerned about is volatility of revenue streams, and I think that, you know, when you look at the ways to reduce that volatility, there aren't very many ways to reduce that very effectively. And I think the Budget Trend Study Committee, one of its major recommendations was to increase the reserve, because one of the things that happens with economic activity, what goes up can come down. We've learned that the hard lesson the way through the 2008 recession. So I think we have to be mindful, as much as we feel that these predictions are based on solid financial transactions, there are a lot of people who think we should increase our reserve by another $1 billion. So that's not something we've proposed in this budget cycle, but we think that the revenue sources that we have on this budget proposal are sustainable both for the short term and for the long term.
Representative Moline.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that, you know, although Iron Rangers are a little bored with this budget proposal, because we have to avoid that dramatic floor fight that we had 2 years ago, I do find it, I guess, refreshing that there isn't a pot of one-time money that's being used to sort of fill holes, which is what we saw last time around. And I think as we're sort of having this little kumbaya moment, maybe that is something we can all come to an agreement to, is that at least there isn't one-time money involved in this budget. And, you know, there are other things that we're probably all going to disagree on, you know, regarding what the tax level should be, you know, what we should do with sales tax, property tax, et cetera. But I think one thing that I, you know, hope we can all agree on is I do see this as more of a structurally sound approach and sustainable approach, that we at least aren't taking one-time money from, you know, certain regions of the state or from the federal government that we know for sure won't be there in the next budget cycle. So that was my only comments, Madam Chair, and to members, is that I hope going forward we can sort of stick to that plan to at least not go back to the one-time money. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Zellers.
Thank
you,
ma'am.
Missed you, by the way.
Yeah, right.
We did. It was great.
You should say that now, Madam Chair, before my questions.
No.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate it, and I have missed you as well. I've missed the tax committee. The only thing that I am very, very sad about is not coming back and seeing Representative Rukavina sit where Representative Benson is, because he and Earhart now, the fight would be even better because you guys own him now. So you can't even blame us for it. So I will miss those fights, but I am very excited to be back in Tax Committee and Commerce Committee as well. But it will be, and I came back, I think, at just the right time. This is going to be fun, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I had two quick questions right away. And the things that are services that are going to be added, will you be taxing daycare services?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, daycare services will not be included.
Okay.
Representative Zellers.
Good news. Madam Chair, or Commissioner, how about lobbyist fees or lobbying fees, government affairs fees?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, they would be taxed.
Double. Representative Zellers.
Crowd looks a little bit scared, Madam Chair. So the going and following on with the services that are going to be taxed, Mr. Commissioner, the professional services that cities and counties employ. So it's architecture. It's you know, we've had a really bad storm go through up north. There's going to be a lot of reconstruction. Are all of those services going to be taxed,
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, to the extent that the cities or counties engage in services that would otherwise be taxable to you or me, like tree removal services or those kind of lawyer services, accounting services, they will be paying that state sales tax.
Representative Sellers.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And then, Commissioner, so, at least I should, maybe I should ask, you're not going to go backwards in time, are you? So we have to redo bonding projects? This isn't going to be retroactive, I hope. I didn't read that in the bill, but we don't have language yet, so I'm a little reluctant, and I trust but verify.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, no, it begins January 1, 2014. We obviously want to take some time to, if we agree to some expansion, to make sure we have time to bring that into people can understand and get ready for it.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, and I think you probably see where I'm going with this, Commissioner, is you're going to create an unfunded liability at that local level that local governments are now going to have to take in an additional 5.5%. And the thing that you and the governor have, the point that you've made over and over again, is that middle class Minnesotans aren't going to pay any, not going to pay any more taxes. It's not going to affect them. And that is one example I'd like to point out where absolutely we will. Now, the $500 rebate on the property taxes may or may not cover whatever increases may, depending on the project. If it's a complete sewer water treatment rehab, it's multiple millions of dollars in a small town. I don't know that the $500 will cover it then. Now you're looking at a new tax bill for somebody in, a town of 2,000 or 3,000 people. But going forward, from here on the sales tax part of it as well, you mentioned that business owners and you know that the average middle class Minnesotan wouldn't be paying any of these sales taxes. Most of it would be on businesses. So say we've got Bob's accounting down in Eagan, and Bob now has to add 5.5% to his bill or the services that he charges for, and he's looking across the river at Hudson, and he sees there was close to 165 or 160 some different CPA or tax firms across the river. So now he's going to have to add that onto his bill. You say it's not going to go to the consumer. So what of the two then is he going to choose? If he does choose, he's either going to have to reduce the price of the product he's providing, so he's going to take 5.5% off, maybe cuts the difference, but raises it 2.5, takes it down, say 2.5 or 2.25. He has to either choose not to pay his employees as much or lay an employee off. He's a limited liability partnership. He and his wife have become, put this business together on their own. They make about $400,000 a year, so they're going to get hit with the new second or fourth tier tax bracket. So when you say that the average consumer isn't going to pay this, how do you explain then where this 5.5% is going to go? Because it's either going to be one of two or three places. He and she are going to take home less in their budget, which you're going to see then in your fourth bracket reductions. The sales tax is not going to be assessed, or it's not going to come in as much because his customers go across the border to Hudson, or they're going to have to lay off employees. How is that not affecting then the average middle class Minnesotan?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the way that we try to be clear about this is for the average consumer, not the business person you're talking about. I'll talk about your business example in just a moment, but for the average consumer, that typically what we all buy day to day and the items that are currently being taxed, that the reduction to 5.5% for all the items of sporting goods or the household goods or furniture, all those things that we currently buy that are subject to 6.875, the rate reduction for all those items will be enough for the average consumer to offset any additional tax they would pay for the expansion. Now, when it comes to businesses, you're raising a different issue. I think the issue for some businesses will they will also see some rate overall reductions. I mean, there are some businesses that buy a lot of, for example, if you're going to remodel your business and put in new furniture, well, that new furniture will be now it's 5.5% instead of 6.875%. So for each business, you really have to look at the business to see what are their buying patterns, you know, what are they buying, what kind of services are they buying, and that's where you get to your example where you're talking about someone who is in the service business and making that, adding that to their bill. And as we've talked about yesterday, and I'm sure we'll talk more about, is the transfer of the business tax. I mean, we understand that when businesses are taxed, they have to figure out how to handle that tax. And if it's a new tax, they've got to figure out do they take reduced profits, or do they lower their prices, or do they pay lower wages, or some of it gets exported out of the state. But on the other hand, as I mentioned, some businesses will actually come out net winners, and so they'll be lowering prices. They'll be lowering prices, maybe raising wages. So it's a wash in some ways. But it's true that, in general, the additional business-to-business service tax will be paid primarily by businesses throughout the state of Minnesota. So I don't want to not be clear about that. But I think you have to look at each individual in terms of whether how it's going to affect them personally.
Representative Zellers, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that is the point, Commissioner, is you're going to stifle that growth. You know, the example used around here is the goose that laid the golden egg, which I think is a stupid example because even my kids don't believe that a goose will crap a golden egg. But the better analogy is your hockey team. Your hockey team has basically three lines. First line is always your best players. We got some of the very best, Zach Parise, Danny Heatley, Mikko Koivu. That's your best line. They produce the most goals. They produce probably the best on defense. They've also probably got some of the highest wages that they're paid by the players. But if you keep playing your first line all the time and you don't get production out of your second or third line, your first line is going to wear down. They're going to become unproductive. They're going to get hurt. So along with the Obama administration, whether it's 2% or 1% or 5%, you keep taxing that group of people, your productivity is going to go down. You're going to get less. The numbers, I don't know, Representative Garofalo is not here, so I can actually say this with a straight face, that he may have been really, really right. You know, the Obama recession is in full force now. The fourth quarter projections were supposed to be 2.1, 2.2%. Not only were they not positive, we have a tenth of a percentage point retraction. That's a big whoops. So all of the revenue projecting, and you said yesterday that, into his question, that you think the economy is, that this growth, and in Minnesota, I think you're right, I think we have better growth than the U.S. economy, but if that economic chicken is going to come home to roost on our entire U.S. economy, we're going to be affected. So to set up this house of cards that we're going to have all this revenue to spend, all these promises, and not have the revenue come in, I guess my question is, what's plan B?
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, you certainly raise concerns. I think we all have concerns to make sure that this Minnesota economy has been outperforming the rest of the country. You're right. And we're really blessed here for the jobs that we've recovered at a faster rate and a bigger rate than the rest of the country. I do know that today the jobs number was 195,000 jobs that were added in the last month. So there are mixed signals coming out. I certainly understand, and we're always concerned about economic growth. So our main concern, frankly, is to make sure that what we do in terms of this budget for Minnesota is one where the investments by businesses are viewed as what's necessary for their continued investment in Minnesota. But that term investment, Representative Zellers, I think is a broad term. And it's not just the tax rates. We understand taxes are important to any business. But we've come to listen to a lot of business people who say their primary concern isn't the tax rate. it's not that it's an inelastic situation. I mean, there are obviously points that you can go too far, but their concern isn't the tax rate first. It's can I get the right employees that are trained and ready to perform my service or make the product? Can I get the educated workforce? Can we have health care that works for people and infrastructure? So it is a balance, we think, and we think the balance in Minnesota has been one where there's a high value that Minnesota businesses come to view Minnesota as a high-value state, that you pay higher taxes than some other states, but you get value for that. And I think that's what Governor Dayton has been trying to achieve, is to make sure that there's value in this budget that is attractive. Because you're right, we want people who are here to grow their business here. We want them not to, you know, grow their business across the state lines. We want businesses to expand and attract a new people here, younger people. When you look at the demographic charts, and I'm in that older group, so I have to be careful how I say this, but as us older guys get older and older, start retiring, and when we see how few people we have, young people, to replace us, our educational system is so critical that we get these young people educated and either trained or college degree into the right area so they can take the jobs that some of us older folks are leaving behind. So this, we certainly understand your concerns. The economic outlook is critical to how we're viewing this going forward, and we hope that it's one of positive growth, but we also think that the budget's got to be both a balance of revenues that are sustainable and fair, but also investments that that the business community will be supportive of.
Representative Sellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm trying to stick to the numbers. I don't disagree with you on education and having a great workforce and all the great and wonderful things that we want from our state. I'm trying to stick to the numbers. And when you raise the OTP tax from 70%, and I will, I disagreed with Governor Plenty on the OTP from 35 to 70, you go from 70 to 90, you're going to have, to Representative Moline's point roundabout, you're going to have a one-time shot of the money, and then you're going to see declining revenues, whether it's the tobacco tax, whether it's the OTP tax. And we saw that with, you know, in particular the OTP, the you know, it's not that much money, it's a few million dollars, but if you're building it on a budget on things that aren't going to, they're going to be there for you the first day, but they're going to continue then to decline going forward. That's my point. And whether, and it's, you said yesterday that there's no evidence that you can find where raising taxes in other states has shown a loss of revenue or a loss of rate payers. And we went and looked. I just did some back of the napkin in Texas, New Jersey to Texas, New York to Florida, New York to Texas. I mean, this isn't a couple folks that decide to just, you know, that's it, I'm done. We're talking 15,000 people, 301,000 people from 1993 to 2010. So what you're going to set up is an environment where people are going to look at Hudson, they're going to look at Sioux Falls, maybe even Iowa, and say, if it's a new rate plus a sales tax on my business, it's not just the tax increase, it's the rate increase on my business, that 5.5%. I mean, how can you not account for that in the budget?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, I think with respect to the tobacco tax, that was a tough decision for the governor, and I think in part, I mean, it's clearly here for the health reasons. It's not here for the revenue. In fact, that is the one issue that we would like to see the revenues decline over time, because that means fewer and fewer people are smoking. That's the whole reason for that being in the budget. So it's strictly there for the health reasons. It does add revenue initially, and we obviously will use that revenue in the general fund, but it's really designed to make sure that that it's there for healthy, to make Minnesotans have an opportunity to cut down smoking, especially for young people. I know there was a hearing this morning in the Senate Tax Committee about the tobacco bill and the concerns about the young people and their smoking patterns. So if you want to criticize that particular issue as one that's declining, but it's designed to decline. It's designed to be there as a health reason, and we hope that it does sort of go away eventually. With respect to people leaving the state, I mean, we've looked at the studies that are out there, and I think part of it is something that we all know, is that Many, many times, and we think in most cases, the decision to move to another state is a complex decision. It's not always made based on one factor or a couple of factors. It's made based on a lot of different factors. And I think we hear sometimes people say tax, but I have to say that there's a reason that South Dakota and North Dakota don't have as many people in, as they do as Minnesota does. Minnesota's an attractive place. It's got a lot to offer. And so, you know, if there are some folks that make that decision, there's nothing we can do about that. But what we're trying to do is make the allure or the lure of Minnesota so positive, both in terms of the quality of life and the opportunities here, that people will stay, even if the rate is somewhat higher.
Commissioner, did you know that Representative Zellers is from one of those Dakotas? Yes,
I do. I do.
Well, Madam Chair, I was going to warn the commissioner. The former majority leader decided to play that game, and I'll just say that I'd advise otherwise. But I never think it's a good idea to make our case by tearing down someone else. That's just my personal politics. But the last thing I promised, Madam Chair.
I have to interrupt you,
if I may.
Representative Zellers. A moment of education for new committee members. What is OTP? So some members, of course, don't know what you're talking about, and so you can tell them.
Other tobacco products. Usually, in this case, my particular constituents, it was cigars.
Representative Zellers has done a lot of work in this area for quite a while. Tobacco kind of.
They're small business owners that, unfortunately, in this case, tax policy has a very immediate and a very, very harmful effect. The two guys that I know, Joel and Jeff, who happen to be constituents of mine and own a business in Maple Grove, used to have three cigar shops. Now they have two. And no offense, and this isn't, you know, to you, Commissioner, but maybe to the governor, if this tax goes through, they're done. It's a $10 cigar, which if anybody who buys a $10 cigar, that's $9 in tax. Everybody's already going to the internet. This will wipe them out. So, now, granted, it's a few million dollars in the state's coffers, but Joel and Jeff have a few employees. They pay rent to another one of my constituents who leases them the building. So, that's my point. And Joel and Jeff are middle-class Minnesotans. I mean, one of them's had to also expand into real estate, so he's out selling real estate. So, you know, he may or may not see the tax benefits. He won't hit the fourth-year bracket anymore, but... it's going to mean he's going to have to close the business. So that's my point on the OTP. And I just have one last question, Madam Chair. I promise I'll be done. But it has to do, again, with the tax policy. And I do agree with the governor on this, and I know it was a difficult decision for him because tobacco taxes are the most regressive. That hits the people who can least afford it the most. If you want them to quit, go with the Blue Cross Blue Shield, you know, a secession product, not that Blue Cross is the one. Go to secession. Don't try to tax people out of it. Besides being mean and cruel, it doesn't work. You know, don't use the tax code to try to stop a policy. But my other question, and this is probably a lot longer and more detailed, the snowbird provisions that are in the bill, I'm unclear about how the rate, are you going to basically be taxing people for the days that they come to the state and are here, and what does that do then to, again, the revenue you're expecting to generate versus what will actually come in?
So members, the snowbird provision, if you're looking for it, is the third page of the past year residents maintaining a Minnesota abode. So, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, first of all, with respect to the cigars, I mean, I appreciate your comments, Representative, and one of the things, though, that we would actually hope would help your friends is to have the tax on Internet sales implemented so that everyone would pay a tax at the Internet if they bought cigars or cigarettes over the Internet. The other thing in terms of North Dakota, I'm from Kansas originally, sir, and so I think Kansas is just like North Dakota without the glitter. So I know where you come from. With respect to the snowbird, if you look at that provision on the pages, it's on the it's in about three or four
three.
Pages. It's called part year residents. So as you know, currently, if you're a non-resident of Minnesota and you have Minnesota-sourced income, you earn income here, or you have income from Minnesota, you currently have to file a non-resident return and pay tax on Minnesota sourced income. And then obviously we have the 183 day rule that if you're in the state for over 183 days, maintain a domicile here, that you are also a resident for tax purposes. This is a new category and would be for those folks who maintain an abode in the state, that are in the state for more than 60 days but less than 183 days. But you have to also maintain the abode for at least 6 months. So if you meet this criteria, you'll be considered a part-year resident. And you would be taxed on your Minnesota source income would be taxed like normal, but if you had other income, it would be taxed based on the number of days you were actually in the state. So if you're in the state for 90 days, you would take a pro rata share of the other income that you had, and it would be subject to Minnesota tax just on those days you were here. It's required that we have a physical connection to the taxation, so that we want to make this a pro rata share of the time you're actually in Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and since Lesh is across from me, I'll go with a cheesy joke, but I think it suffices to say you're not in Kansas anymore. So what about the lake cabin owners from Iowa or South Dakota or North Dakota or Wisconsin that are coming over? How are there going to be provisions in there? Say it's a really bad summer and they're only here for, they fall within that category. Are you going to then tax cabin owners, so we're going to, besides being anti-grandparent, we're anti-cabin?
Are you talking about, when you said coming over, are these non-Minnesota residents
right.
we're talking about now?
Right.
So, Iowans and, okay.
Right.
Commissioner. Foreigners, yeah. Exactly, Representative Davids. Foreigners. Commissioner.
Anti-Iowa in the corner.
Madam Chair, Representative, one of the key elements is you have to have maintain an abode for at least 6 months. So if you're just maintaining an abode and you rent a cabin, or it's just for 60 days or even 90 days, under the provisions, you have to have at least a 6 month lease or own a place in Minnesota. So it takes at least that connection before it kicks in. So it wouldn't cover a lot of the people who just rent a cabin for a few weeks or for the whole summer, unless they had 6 months of an abode in Minnesota under rent or they owned it.
Representative Zeller.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, and that's the Commissioner, that's my point. I mean, if you've been to some of our glorious lakes, these aren't just cabins. These are, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 bedroom year-round homes that people go back and forth, have Christmas there. So are we going to have revenue agents out there on Christmas Eve making sure that you were there for Thanksgiving and Christmas? Now you're at 6 months. Now we're going to tax you as a resident? Or, I mean, I'm unclear of it, because that doesn't, again, we don't have a bill and there's no language we can look at, but I'm unclear that you're going to actually tax some of these cabin owners, and it's going to be disincentive to buy a cabin over here.
Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, I think the concern has been that when people spend at least 60 days but under 183 days, that they are participating a lot in the infrastructure that we have in Minnesota, and that this is one way to help make them pay their fair share of the time that they spend in Minnesota.
That's very, very disconcerting, Madam Chair, but thank you for the opportunity to ask questions.
Thank you. And I'm going to read the list. Earhart, Loeffler, Liebling, Marquardt, Davids. Oh, I'm sorry. Earhart, Loeffler, Liebling, Davids, Marquardt. Myra, I can't read my handwriting. Carlson, Anderson, Barrett, Benson. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. By the way, I wasn't laughing at you a few minutes ago. I was laughing at the whole situation that you were describing so well. Your soliloquy was great, and I appreciate it. Commissioner, I wanted to ask if you satisfy the structural imbalance here. What maintains, once you plug in the 1.1 or whatever is going to be here, the following biennium, if we don't slow down the more rapid increase of spending, we're going to be right back in the same boat, because the thing that you've solved on one hand, the other hand keeps climbing. So what happens then? Do we raise taxes again? Or
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, I think the key is to make sure that the spending matches, you know, the budget is sustainable. I think one of the things, if you look at the overall price of government that we have in Minnesota, the governor's proposal would bring that number up slightly, but it's still way below the levels we had back in the 1990s. So I think the key, Representative, is that we maintain vigilance and we maintain, we try to save money wherever we can. We try to make cuts wherever we can. But the key for the governor is to make sure that the agencies propose budgets and that make sense, that are as cost-effective as possible, that make cuts where they can, but that we also are mindful of what our revenue stream is. And I think that's, you're raising a really critical point, that we need to make sure that we don't lose sight of matching our spending with our revenue. And that's certainly what we've been trying to do through the governor's budgeting process.
Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair and Mr. Commissioner, the broadening of the sales taxes for to eradicate as much as possible the volatility. Do I understand that? Is that that's the prime objective there?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, that is one issue. I mean, to the extent in any particular tax, the more you broaden it, the more likely it is that it won't be quite as volatile. But some taxes are pretty volatile. But broadening tax bases generally have the effect of reducing some of the volatility. But the other thing is trying to make sure that we believe it's also a more fair tax system by reducing the rate that consumers pay for everything, that the expansion to services is a more fair way to distribute that tax burden in the economy. Because remember, our economy now is two-thirds of our economy is really based on services being bought and sold, not goods. And that's part of the other issue as well.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for helping us understand all the pieces of this. I want to personally say I support and thank you for stepping forward on the tax increase for tobacco for health reasons, because it really does have an impact. And Representative Zellers, I really appreciate that you probably know better than I do exactly how you calculated on little cigars and big cigars and all those sorts of things. But I'm on the Health and Human Services Committee and have worked in that field more, and I have to tell you, the research is really, really clear that for the most price-sensitive group that we worry about, which is our youth, price makes a big difference on whether kids take this up and wrestle with it for the whole rest of their life. And the evidence is very, very clear that if you make that price of entry into smoking higher, you do actually see the impact on how many youth actually do take up smoking. It might motivate some of the others, the adults who are already hooked, to say, this is the excuse for me to try again. But I do think it really does have some good research in terms of showing that it long-term does it. And I know bipartisanly there's frustration with the growth in the medical assistance budget, which sometimes feels like it's going to overtake the whole budget if we don't manage health care costs. And this is our biggest preventable cause of illness, disability, and premature death is the addiction to tobacco products. And so the research is pretty clear that if we can reduce people getting into the habit, and it's usually acquired in youth, we can long-term, looking at long-term sustainability, make a difference. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy for the people who are currently addicted, and there are people who, for whom this is as addictive as heroin. We know that people differ in their ability to deal with it, but I do think it is a good step forward for our kids and for the long-term budget health of the state to have less people dependent on that. When I talk to business owners in my area, a lot of what I hear about from them is more the property taxes, and maybe it's because they're more small businesses, but not all. And it seems to me that that's where I think there's going to be some payback. But I thought I heard you say yesterday that 94% of businesses wouldn't pay more given the overall, you know, shifting of the different pieces of this, or I wasn't sure if you respond, or just responding to the fourth tier, Commissioner.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I was talking about the fourth tier. So it's true, approximately 94% of those small businesses that have positive income, remember, we're not including those, there's a lot of businesses out there that have negative income, that have losses, that are not making money. But if you look at just those business in the small businesses, that sole proprietorships and other ones that have positive income, of those, about 94% of those entities, businesses, will not have income above the $250,000 or $150,000 limit for the fourth tier.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you. And, you know, on that fourth tier, I think there's some confusion, and I think we could just go through it a little slower. I think, you know, for those of us who've worked with this, it's still a graph sometimes, and let alone the public who's watching us. But I believe I heard you say yesterday that for that household that has, you know, $250,000 of taxable income, that that would actually be more equivalent to their having $306,000 in real income, sort of if they got it all from an employer, what would show up on their W-2. And that they would, the average person would have that big a gap in deductions and credits and charitable giving and all those sorts of things. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. For a married couple with two kids, we try to pick a couple of scenarios that people can identify with. But so if you take a married couple with two kids with a typical deductions and exemptions and standard deductions, they would earn, if they earned about $306,000 in total income in their household income, that would often translate to about $250,000 in taxable income, and therefore they wouldn't have any additional tax under the new fourth tier. It's about $179,000 for a single person. So for the typical single person who has $179,000 in total tax, the typical deductions and exemptions, they would be at about $150,000 taxable income. So that's sort of the gross income or household income thresholds that you have typically before the fourth tier would kick in.
Representative Loeffler.
Okay, and that's helpful because I think people see those numbers and they think that's your take-home pay, and it isn't. We always have to go through all the mechanics. And in terms of how it works, as I understand it too, is if you're that person who is making $306,000, or you and your spouse are, and then you get a raise, and all of a sudden you're now at $336,000, you're only paying the new marginal rate on that extra new $30,000 that comes into your household budget. That rest of it is still taxed as it is currently.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, correct. So we're dealing with marginal rates. So you're right. Only the income above those thresholds is subject to the new fourth tier. And that's why the effective tax rate for most folks won't change very much for this, because it'll take quite a bit of income to get above these thresholds before your effective tax rate really goes up very much. So only that. So if we had $10,000 of additional income that was into the fourth tier, you would pay the additional 2% or $200 on that is that right? $10,000. Is my math right?
Yes.
It's always hard to do math up here. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner and Madam Chair. I do think it is hard for all of us sometimes to do that. I think we all suffer from calculator brain. At the same time, I think it's really important for people to realize that, you know, these are going to affect a lot less people than I think maybe people expect. And, you know, I personally, if I was offered a, you know, $20,000 raise and I had to pay an extra, you know, few percentage more on that $20,000, it's still a really good deal to me, even if it would mean I could give a couple thousand more to the schools and the university. But I also wanted to know, I thought you said that our currently our middle-income households in general pay about 12.3% of their income in state and local taxes combined, and that the top 2%, which would be subject to this new fourth tier, pays about 9.7%, and I think that's in the materials you gave us. But I didn't see what does it come out with now after you implement your suggestion. Are the top 2% still advantaged compared to the general middle class?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a good question, and a similar one that Representative Davis asked yesterday. We'll get we don't have that information quite ready yet, but what we'll do is show the overall effect of this fourth tier and how it will change the amount that's paid by the upper income brackets. But it's sort of a complex computation because we have to factor in not only the fourth tier but the other changes as well. But it will right now it's 9.7%, as you mentioned, for the top 2%. That's the total amount of taxes they pay, state taxes for property tax, sales tax, income tax, and other taxes. That's their percentage of household income that goes toward total taxes right now, and our guess is that it's going to go up. We just don't know exactly how much yet.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I look forward to getting that, and I do think that we should guide our work as much as we can by principles and values, and we can disagree about the path towards them, but I think trying to move towards greater fairness and productive progressivity, which I think is an assumption on most people, that the more you earn, the more you pay. You know, I think more that we can work towards those goals, I think I'd be pleased to be working with you on that.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Liebling, then David, then Marquardt. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure where to face here. This is really confusing to me. But, well, when I, first of all, I want to say I'm going to have to channel Representative Rukavina because I have to leave pretty soon, and I, you know, he's kind of famous for, you know, he's famous for making his statement and then leaving. So I'm going to do that to you today, I'm afraid. But when I first raised my hand yesterday to put myself on the list, I really wanted to respond to some of the rhetoric that I was hearing. And just to say that, you know, we hear these ways, certain ways of talking about things that have gotten to be pretty common. You know, we hear this job-killing taxes as though job-killing was a modifier that goes right with taxes. And we hear the phrase job providers all the time. And I just wanted to say, you know, even today, and in the time I've had to go in and out a bit, but a lot of rhetoric about, you know, that when we're taxing something, we're against somebody. We want to hurt somebody. And I just want to really express the fact that I think that the chair said it very well. You know, we're kind of in this enterprise together. We're trying to figure out the best things for Minnesotans. Obviously, we have some differences about how we view what our values are a little bit and how we want to come out on this. And she stated it very well. But I just wanted to say that I think that Minnesotans are really tired of this kind of rhetoric. Just this repeated, the sort of stuff they saw in the campaign literature. And I know there was plenty of it in my district. And, you know, I was killing jobs, and I was killing jobs. And, you know, Minnesotans didn't buy that. And I think they're tired of that. I think the message was that they want us to work on stuff, get stuff done, do our best. They know we're not perfect. They know that what we come out with may have to be adjusted a little bit in the future. And nobody here, least of all the governor, is trying to pretend that he has the perfect answer. But let's all kind of, you know, understand that job-killing taxes is just really silly rhetoric, because we know that taxes, obviously, if you tax something too much, you know, you're going to probably get rid of that thing. We know that taxes have certain effects, but having a tax does not mean that we're going to kill jobs. And we, some of us happen to believe that government investment, which comes from taxes, is good for jobs. And I think there's plenty of evidence for that. So we're all trying to strike a balance here. I think the governor's made a very bold, good, honest first step. And we should really appreciate that. And I just would ask people to tone down some of this, just kind of stop playing the same tapes. Because frankly, I'm tired of the campaign. And I think Minnesotans would like us to take a couple years between campaigns and govern. And when you hear this rhetoric over and over, it's just like we're still running the campaign and still trying to fight the same points that were fought over. And finally, I just wanted to say I heard something about don't try to change behavior through taxes, which I don't know if I got that quite right. We were talking about tobacco taxes, you know, that we're trying to change behavior. Certainly we are trying to change behavior through tobacco taxes. I think Representative Loeffler was just talking about it. We know very well that raising taxes on tobacco products discourages young smokers at the very least and helps adults as well. And that saves us a ton of money on the back end, not to mention the human cost to that. But if somebody thinks it's not legitimate to try to change behavior with taxes, then they're probably in the wrong place here, because we do that all the time in different directions. When we give somebody a tax break, we're often trying to incentivize certain behavior. Angel tax credits, what do people think that's about? right? That's about trying to get people to make investments in something that they might not otherwise. That's certainly trying to influence behavior. So, you know, let's not, we can argue about what behavior we should influence or try to influence and at what price. But let's not pretend that we don't influence behavior around here with tax policy, because we certainly do. So I just wanted to, since I had to wait so long to have my say, Madam Chair, I hope you don't mind that I'm just making kind of the sort of statements we often make in here.
Thank you for your Representative Rukavina imitation.
Yeah, so
so political.
You have to, like, angrily stomp out, though.
Then, Madam Chair, do I get to respond? Since about,
well, then you better stay.
90% of it was directed towards
Sellers
me.
Representative would like to respond to a little bit of that, so hang on a minute, Representative Leland, Representative Sellers.
And, Madam Chair, you said it probably best when you said, let's try to tone down, let's try to talk about the policy. When you accuse the people who you disagree with of spewing their rhetoric, I think is what I exactly wrote down, I don't think you're going to encourage a lot of favor on our side when you call our beliefs rhetoric. My family are all small business owners. When you raise taxes on small business owners, they have one of two choices. They're going to have to take home less, or they're going to have to lay off employees. All of my family have had to go through that. They can charge more, sure, Representative Benson, and then they go to Wisconsin or they go to your competitor. So when you call what we believe or what we grew up with rhetoric, and if you want to go back to the campaign trail and some of the things that were said about our candidates and stealing from kids and stealing from old people, I think the president himself said Republicans want dirty air, dirty water. I mean, let's not throw too many big, giant rocks in our glass houses. But Representative Liebling, I said that the reason I think it's a bad idea to tax cigarettes and to raise taxes on cigarettes because it affects those who can least afford it the most. And it can nominally, yes, you can say that it will stop some people from actually increasing their use or not. Representative Paymar and I, you know, quit our two habits on our own without having a tax increase. And if that's what you want, tax the hell out of it then. Make it a $3 tax. Make it a $5 tax if that's what you want. But that's not what you're saying here. You're saying you want it for the revenue. Or, well, the governor's budget is. You say, and Representative Waffler, I think, would probably agree with you, but then raise the tax to $3 or $4. If you want everybody to quit smoking, be honest about it. But my point is you're actually hurting the people who you, again, profess to want to help the most, those of us in the middle class. With your tax policy, it's going to hurt those who can least afford it the most.
Representative Sellers, I'm going to let Representative Leland respond, but later, privately, I'd love to know these habits that you and Representative Paymar quit. Then you can tell us. You can tell us offline what they are. But
they were both
Representative Leland.
They're both tobacco related, Madam Chair.
Well, okay, thank you.
All right.
I had no idea about either one of you ever using any tobacco products, but Representative Leland.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. So, Representative Zellers, first of all, I think that the commissioner made it really clear that the tobacco tax proposal is not for the revenue, that it's really for the health benefit. And he explained at length that, you know, we all hope that that's a source that diminishes as people stop smoking. So just to clear that one up. And then I just want to make clear, I'm not saying that when you express your concern about what will happen, that that's just rhetoric. What I'm talking about is the catchphrases. You know, that every time we use the word, and it wasn't you, as a matter of fact, that I was referring to with this, but when you say taxes, every time you say the word taxes, it doesn't have to be preceded by job killing. That's what I'm calling rhetoric. Just the use of a certain way of, you know, that sheds heat but no light. I'm not talking about your discussion about what you're afraid will happen in certain circumstances. I think that's what we're here for, to have that kind of discussion. And I hope we have more of that. I was really more referring to what we heard yesterday, and what we get, and sort of this accusation that I hope we'll leave outside the room, that, you know, if we think this or that could be taxed, that it's because we don't like this or that entity, or, you know, I hope we can stay away from that and talk about what the real effect might be, and not just use those phrases like job-killing taxes. And the other one that I dislike, and I, you know, in which comes out, I think, pretty often, is this idea of the job providers, you know, as though providing a job is something that somebody does for a charitable purpose. You know, we do it all because we're nice people. We want to just provide the jobs. And if you let us have as much money as we can accumulate, we'll just provide the jobs. And the more we can accumulate, the more we'll provide. And I think that's a pretty inaccurate view of what business does. The business thinks that adding an employee will help the bottom line. They're going to add that employee. They're not providing it out of the goodness of their hearts, although they may, in fact, be wonderful people. But you know, that job providers thing, I always find very a troubling rhetoric, you know, not to say that our businesses aren't very important and that jobs aren't important. But let's talk about the effect and not as though there are people who are, you know, have a halo around them because they're the ones that do all the good in society by providing all the jobs. So that said, Madam Chair, I do have to leave, and so
if
Representative
Thank
Zellers
you.
Wants to respond, I'll have to watch the tape.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Zellers.
Go without
Okay, so now it's going to be Representative Davids, Marquardt, Myra. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to talk about job-killing tax increases on our job providers. Catchphrases. We do use code words around this place all the time. And, Commissioner, how in the world we can say there's a $2.1 billion job-killing tax increase on all Minnesotans and say it's not going to cost anything is bizarre at best to me. That, to me, in my definition, that's a gimmick. Code words. Fair share. What does fair share mean? That means Greg Davids pays more, is what that means. More investments. More investments. That means spending more. Now, my question to you, Commissioner, is where is this balanced approach? More code words. I always hear about balanced approach. I had an email from a constituent, and it said, we need a balanced approach. And I emailed him back, and I said, what in the world are you talking about? There is no balance. Taxes are going up, and there's nothing I can do about it. So where's the balance? There is no balance. So let's just cut the balance stuff, unless you can describe to me where there's a balanced approach in the governor's proposal. There is no balance. This is an all-tax solution, massive tax increases on all Minnesotans. This budget, in my estimation, should be titled a Taxes Gone Wild budget, because that's what it is. Now, Madam Chair, I thank you so much for your honesty. You sat here today and said, taxes are going up. And that's true. And I appreciate that from you. One of my hopes is, I actually have some faith. I shouldn't say faith. I only have faith in my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. But I have hope in you. I have hope in you that you can be a moderating factor, because you're up against, I think, an insurmountable odds of taxes gone wild. And you, I actually have some hope in. And so I thank you for your honesty. To all Minnesotans, taxes are going up. They're going up big time. Commissioner, when I don't know how you say with a straight face that when you have taxes that penalize success, like a fourth tier, that's not, we just heard from my good friend Representative Liebling, that taxes do affect behavior. You're doggone right they affect behavior, Commissioner. So how can anyone say that if you go to a fourth tier, that business person is saying, you know, I was going to expand in Minnesota? Maybe not. I've got a good idea. I'm going to expand in Minnesota? No way. And this hurts me. This hurts me greatly, because I have started many businesses in my life, all in Minnesota. I love this state. I'll be starting more businesses. But in my mind, I'm questioning, where am I going to start that? Texas? Florida? South Dakota? Tennessee? Because tax policy affects behavior. And if you're going to go to a fourth tier, that affects behavior. I'm a Minnesotan. My businesses are in Minnesota. I want to keep them here. You're not helping me. I'm hoping Lincheski can help me. Because my next business, I want to start here. And in all the businesses I've started, I've never had pause as to where that business would start. It's going to be here. But now I'm pausing. I look at the governor's budget proposals, I'm going to say, why? Why are we penalizing success? Why? I spoke to a group of high school seniors the other day, and they said that one of the questions was, what are you going to do to protect the middle class? And I said, nothing. I don't want to be in the middle class. Do you wake up every morning and say, oh, I want to be in the middle class? After my quadruple bypass surgery, every morning when I get up, the first thing I do is, first of all, thank God that I got up. That's first thing. Number two is that we're born in a land of opportunity. The governor's budget penalizes success. It penalized. I got a call from a guy when 2 years ago when Governor Dayton proposed raising taxes, and he's yelling at me on the phone. I'm on the House floor. He's yelling at me. He says, "Why are you raising taxes on me? I've worked 30 years of my life. You're going to raise tax on anybody over $250,000? I'm going to work till September, lay my folks off, and go home and call it a day because I ain't working for you, Davids." And I said, "Hey, I'm on your side," and he keeps yelling at me. And I said, "Sir, you're right on, baby." And he says, "Oh, you agree with me?" I said, "Yes. I don't want to penalize your success." But that's what the governor's budget does. That's what a fourth tier does. That's what taxing all these services does. I want to start a business, another one. I want to start it in Minnesota. Commissioner, please help me. Now, my question is, and don't ask me to repeat the question. That's what I do when someone goes on with a long question. How can you say with a straight face that this is a balanced approach when it's an all-tax approach? How is this balanced?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, well, I'm so glad we lowered the rhetoric in here a little bit.
Job-killing tactic.
thank you for your zeal, and I love the zeal to which you bring your forces to this debate. And I appreciate that. It's balanced. First of all, let me talk about the balance. I mean, it's balanced because first of all, we actually solved the deficit. I mean, there's a $1.1 billion deficit. Okay, so if you don't raise revenue, what are you going to cut, who are you going to cut, and where are those cuts going to be? Number one, if you don't do anything, you've got to come up with, of a different view, with no new revenue, you've got to solve a $1.1 billion deficit, all right? Number two, we believe that the taxes can be investments. Many economists talk about the investment side of taxes, that businesses do understand investments. They do understand, in fact, Minnesota has had a tradition of investing in higher education and quality of life here. You know, for the last 30 or 40 years, if the whole idea of a new tax is going to kill Minnesota, it would already be dead. Look at Minnesota. It's a great state. It continues to grow. High tax states or higher tax states often have great value. I mean, Governor Dayton talks about Minnesota being a great value because we have taxes that actually buy things that businesses want in terms of an educated workforce and infrastructure. So anyway, I'm going off here a little bit. I want to go back to the balance. So the first thing we do is we solve the deficit, and then we make the investments that we think are critical to businesses staying here and wanting to stay here. Then the third thing we do is we pay back our debt, the $1.1 billion debt. If you don't raise any additional revenue, how are you going to pay back the $1.1 billion debt that we owe the schools? So this is another way that we can, it's balanced because we solve the deficit, we make investments, we pay back the school debt, and in addition, we have a balance going forward in 2016 and 2017. So it's completely balanced in the sense that the revenue matches the spending. The revenue side is balanced because we believe it taxes people at a fair level and it makes the system more progressive. And that's what the governor is trying to do, is put together a revenue package that sustains the spending, the investments that we all want to make.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I need to finish my story a little bit on the senior class. When I was asked, you know, what are you going to do for the middle class? What I'm going to do for them is try and get them out of the middle class. I don't think it should be anybody's goal on this planet to get to be in the middle class. I started with nothing. I made it to the middle class and beyond. Okay? So this mentality of we all have to be average. Even Garrison Keillor says we're all above average in Minnesota. But your balanced approach discussion, Commissioner, had nothing to do with balance. You had to do with paying the bills. And the only way you're going to do it is by raising taxes. There's no balance. Balance means that, okay, you cut some spending and you raise some revenues, about 50-50. You're 100% raising revenues. There's no balance there. Yeah, you're balancing the books, but not in a balanced way.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are cuts in the budget. I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but there are both cuts, actual cuts in the budget, and there's a lot of redirected savings that we've made. I think part of the issue, and you're exactly right, that we need to be very careful in how we spend taxpayers' dollars. I think one of the keys that we've been able to do, for example, Commissioner Jessen in the healthcare area has been able to renegotiate these contracts in a way that has saved hundreds of millions of dollars. So we've got to be smarter. We've got to use the money that we have in a smarter way. But the budget does have savings and it does have cuts, and we do rely on revenue. That's true.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And thank you, Commissioner, for that. I just have to leave now. I have to go to a press conference with Representative Liebling about the Mayo Clinic. So
yes,
we're going to talk about job creating. Okay. Scenarios.
Excellent. Representative Marquardt. Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And, you know, I'm sick and tired waking up every morning being in the middle of the pack in education. And I'd like to someday talk about what our achievement gap is costing the state in terms of a loss of gross domestic product. And it's 2 or 3%. 2 or 3%. So we can talk about that side of the ledger. But that's another day. Budgets are about priorities. Budgets are about setting a vision for the future. And everyone around this table wants a better Minnesota. So you've got several, the governor has several principles in his budget. He solves the budget structurally, not just this year, but into the future. He pays back our IOUs in the debt, school shift, and has significant investments in education and property tax relief. So my question, Commissioner, is how does that fit in to the governor's vision for this state? I mean, those principles that you've listed.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, thank you for that question. I think, you know, one of the things that that I've had the pleasure and honor in serving with Governor Dayton is learning firsthand that vision that he has for the state of Minnesota. And that is clearly wanting to make sure that we chart a future course for Minnesota, that when he leaves being governor, that we're on a much better course in terms of education, infrastructure, and our budget being balanced. So we're on a positive course that will make Minnesota continue to be one of those really unique states. And that's one of the things that he has such compassion about, is this state and the fact that it is known for being an outlier in the sense of being having an excellent quality of life, an excellent educational system, and great infrastructure. He really wants to make sure that Minnesota continues to move forward, not backwards. We need to invest more for the future, because we have Fortune 500 companies, and they will only stay in a state that's top-notch and headed in the right direction.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. And you know, I think that's really been lacking here in the last decade, is a real vision for where we want this budget. We come out and it's numbers and it's cuts, and we talk taxing and spending, and we really don't talk about what is the vision for this state. And the folks in the state are looking for leadership and a vision. That's what they want more than anything, and I'm looking forward to talking more about that vision that the governor has as this progresses. Madam Chair, I don't know how much time we have left.
We have a few minutes. Representative Marquardt, you're going to be the last person up today.
Okay, very good. I know there's been some talk about kind of the stability into the future of the budget. And when we look out at this handout that the governor had, there's a sheet here that has the numbers into the future. And I notice that actually in the 16 and 17, revenues are higher than spending by $481 million in the first year and $771 in the next year, which means it sounds like it's becoming more stable. And, of course, you have to pay off the shift with some of that. But I also noted, and we've talked about a lot the spending portion, that the spending increase from fiscal 16 to fiscal 17 is about 1.5%. I see that as very reasonable. And so am I reading these numbers correctly, Mr. Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. And I think that was one of the keys that Governor Dayton made it clear to all of the agencies and everyone who wanted to invest in Minnesota going forward, that we have to prioritize. We can't do everything. We've got to do those things that we need to prioritize, and the investments have to be within reason, and they have to fit a revenue system that we can sustain. So he was very clear to all the agencies and on all the people in the government, if you're going to put forward an idea, we've got to make sure it fits into the budget going forward as well as the current biennium.
think you're Representative Marquardt. In closing.
Okay, very good. Madam Chair, all I ask for members to do this as an assignment is, I think what
is...
She's
a high school teacher, right?
Yes.
Everyone knows that.
This part right here where it says modernizing our sales taxes, the first page are those things that are still exempt. And then the second page are things that we're currently paying sales taxes on but would pay less. And then the third page, things that are new. And I would like you to go through those, everyone, and jot down the ones you actually paid for in the last year. And, you know, I look at the ones that are being taxed new. You know, I don't plan to get a tattoo or a body piercing in the next year. No, I'm going to let the... Yeah.
Are you sure?
And so I'm not going to have... And, you know I could take dancing lessons and golf and tennis. I need them, but I'm not going to take them this year. But, you know, I do need a fishing pole that I'll pay less on. And I could, you know, my cell phone I need, I'm going to pay less on. All the household goods I use, I'm going to pay less on. Hopefully my snow blower is still working well. Snow, I would pay less on that, and a shovel and a snowmobile if I want to enjoy that. Hunting gear is going to be cheaper, pay less tax. So I want people to take a look at that and jot down all the ones and then kind of figure it out before we just make all these generalities, because you make a great point, Commissioner. This is going to impact people differently. And it's going to impact businesses differently. So let's do the research before we just throw cold water on it and really see how it impacts people here around this table. So thank you very much, and thanks for your leadership.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you all. We are adjourned.